From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. I'm sitting in for Terry Gross, who's vacationing through next week. Lawrence Halprin is an artist whose palette is the public space. He's been described as a mix of urban planner, architect, artist, and ecologist. We'll talk with Lawrence Halprin on this edition of Fresh Air. Also today, West Coast novelist Don Carpenter shares his thoughts on the East Coast literary scene. Critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews the new work from performance artist John O'Keefe. And we have a remembrance of travel writer and novelist Bruce Chatwin. That's all coming up on this edition of Fresh Air. My guest today is Lawrence Halprin, a landscape architect and urban planner. He and his firm evolved a style that brings a sense of the great outdoors back to crowded and dirty cities in startling ways. His Levi Plaza Park in San Francisco transports the feel of a high Sierra stream flowing through a meadow and granite boulders to downtown. So persuasive is his design that birds and dragonflies have returned to the area. Visitors to San Francisco may know his work, Ghirardelli Square, finished now 20 years ago, where people move around fountains, stores, and plazas in the former chocolate factory. Halprin's work there and at Sea Ranch on the California coast, in Minneapolis and Portland, inspired other planners to rethink how public places are designed. His plan for the park, now covering part of a Seattle freeway, uses rushing water to wash out the sounds of the Interstate 5 traffic beneath it and brought back to life a part of the city the freeway had killed. Lawrence Halprin has worked in his own large firm, and now at the age of 72, heads a small atelier which still designs projects in this country, such as the Bunker Hill Steps in Los Angeles and abroad in Jerusalem and Florence. Part of planning for a space, whether it's a backyard or a street or a coastline, is to see what's there and how it's used. I wondered what Halprin looks out for when he first comes upon a space he's been asked to change.
In the field that I'm in, there are always two things or more that affect what I do and how I think about things. Very often, the first thing I do is get an intuitive sense about things. When I walk through it, I try to empathize about how it feels. It's like meeting somebody at the very beginning. When you first meet somebody, some of the most powerful images that you maintain, even though you know them for years and years afterwards, is that first impression of what they look like, how they move, how they sit, how they smile, how you feel about them, even in a funny way, how they smell. I don't mean that literally. Hmm. And it isn't analytical at the beginning. It's completely intuitive. And you might say aesthetic is the wrong word, but it's anthropomorphic, in a sense. Then the next thing I try to do is to think about how it functions. Then I become much more analytical. How are people using this street? What do they want from it? Is the traffic moving up and down? How are the spaces themselves? How high are the buildings around it? How is it functioning in the city? What is its context? And then I try to put them together and say, okay, between these two things, how are we poetically and aesthetically what are we going to try to make of this place so that it improves both, that it maintains its sense of place as a person, as a place, and then also how can it function better?
You developed your own system for taking notes and projecting behavior in a space called motation. What does that word mean, and how does motation work?
Well, the word motation is a made up word. It's a synthetic word that I put together from notations, which are like musical notations or sketches, and motion, because in all these places that I design and that I'm always in and involved in, I'm always thinking about how people move through it, how their lives are influenced by it, which are non-static, not visually so much, because that's rather easy, but how as you move around, you see this, you see that, you encounter people, you encounter things. And so the two words came together in a term called motation, and the motation system, which I developed, gives me a tool by which I can this material together in graphic form so that I can look at it and study it It's a form of architecture in motion, you might say, or architectural drawing in motion. And
this sounds very akin to dance choreography.
It's exactly the same as dance choreography. In fact, there are systems. My wife, as you know, is a dancer, and one of the early reasons that I put together this motation system was that she asked me at one point to choreograph some dances for her and to make them visible so that we could teach other people to dance with her. And I was doing the stage sets as well, and so I developed this system of graphically delineating what people would do in a stage, on a stage, with costume and so forth. And this developed the idea of motation, which I have since applied over and over again to cities and transit systems and pedestrian ways and so forth.
I get the sense that you view a space in which people move throughout the day as theater.
Well, sure. Theater, when I say sure, I suppose I should say yes. But it seems to me so inherently humanistic to say yes, of course, because people are constantly in motion, and they are doing things constantly in their lives that not only are functional, but are ritualistic and mythical things which are communicating always with other people, with their environment. And that's how I perceive everything that I do in new work and in the conservation of old work.
You played baseball as a young man. Were you good enough to think about being a professional?
Oh, yeah. I think one of the great questions that will remain with me for the rest of my life, I was going to go up with the Dodgers.
We're talking Brooklyn Dodgers here, right?
That's the only kind of Dodgers there are, for heaven's sakes. That was after prep school, and I was going up as a pitcher. And at that moment in time, I decided instead to take the adventure of going to Israel, and I did. And when I came back 3 years later, it wasn't so much that I'd lost it, but I was less interested in becoming a professional baseball player.
I look at a baseball diamond, and I see that as a piece of landscape architecture that has choreography within it. There's a set of rules that people follow. Is that similar to what you try to do with a space? You set up rules by putting in furniture, trees, bits of water, ponds, curving paths. Do you try to set up rules for people who use a space?
Yes and no. I think what I try to do instead of setting up rules is set up opportunities. And in that sense, it's a little different than a game. I try to in the spaces that I use, and bear in mind that I'm also dealing with plazas which have no often as Venice or what we're doing in Florence. These spaces are mostly spaces. They're like great outdoor rooms without cover, without a top, often with no plantings at all, but beautiful pavings, benches, sculpture, fountains, and so forth. And the main thing I try to do is not so much set up the rules as because those are built into the environment itself, but to make opportunities more available for people, make it possible for people to enrich their lives through it. Do you follow the difference?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that interests me more because rules are man-made and opportunities are human-made.
Is there a natural example that you use as sort of your main working metaphor for these natural opportunities? Is there a place mm-hmm. in the world that's always inspired you to which mm-hmm. you return? Where is that?
I have two sources that inspire me and have a lot to do with my work. One is the High Sierra, and natural phenomena like the High Sierra, where when you spend time up in the High Sierra, you see the very source of both humanity and how people react to nature, because there, up in those high mountains, erosion forms create landscapes that are ineffable in their poetry and their beauty. You can see the same kind of thing in the Southwest, where the great mesas and the structures that are built on them become organic. They become linked to nature in the sense that the difference between the man-made phenomenon and the nature-made are so similar because of the attitude in which they were built that you can't tell the difference between the two. One enhances the other. That's one source. The other source for me is the incredible sense that art can bring into human life. Art in the sense that great artists like Michelangelo in our own time, some of the great architects like Richard Rogers and James Stirling and others can bring to people, where they produce for people through their ability to imagine the poetry that will emerge out of what they make, the painting, the sculpture, how those things can enhance people's lives. And so when, as I think about things, I think about both. Nature as a great poetic manifestation of the universe and how the land has become on its own, and then the artistry that great artists can bring to all our lives.
You worked in a kibbutz in Israel as a young man. How did this change your sense of how people work together?
Well, let's see. It's not so much how people work together that influenced me on a kibbutz. I worked on a kibbutz between prep school and college for 3 years. It was one of the deeply important experiences of my life. It had a lot to do not only with how people live together and work together, but also on the whole basis of a value system in life. It influenced my point of view about the value of labor, of work, of how making things with your own hands is important, how about the idea of non-competition in the sense of what's mine is mine and what's yours is yours, but the opportunity that people have when living in a community of that kind to share. It profoundly affected my deep-seated belief in democracy, because in a kibbutz, no one person is more equal than any other person. Each one has a vote. In fact, they rotate management to the point that everybody is always involved in all aspects of a kibbutz. And so, in a sense, I saw in action a utopian point of view, a way which, in a profound sense, has a lot to do with some of the utopian communities that were here in America in the middle of the 18th century, of the 19th century, 100 years ago. And even now, if you go down to the Southwest and see some of the Native American communities, has a lot to do with their point of view as well. That is, that nobody owns any land. Land is something that is God-given's gift to humanity and to the people who are occupying it, that you can't sell land. That's a point of view that the kibbutz has, and which Native Americans have.
I think
funny way, I believe in too. So, and on all kinds of levels, it affected my point of view about life in general.
Uh-huh. One of your projects in Portland is the Lovejoy, the Fountain and Plaza area, which makes a great use of water. And in fact, a lot of your projects make use of flowing water, waterfalls. What for you is important about the use of water in public spaces? How do people react to it?
Well, people seem to react to it on a number of levels. One is on the pure joy of involving themselves with it. Particularly, children like to climb in it and splash in it. But there's another basis on which people love to use and be involved in water, and that's a biological level. We come from water. Water is at the essence and the core of our existence. On a biological level, most of our bodies, as you know, are water. Our ancestors came out of the water, and for all kinds of water reasons, water is life-giving. It is at the core of how we live, and for that reason, people empathize with it in a profound way that goes way beyond function. the liveliness of water in a city becomes extremely important as well, because it has sound, it splashes, it's cooling, it moves, and for all of those reasons, people just love water and enjoy it, and I love to bring it into the city because it is a life-giving, enjoyable thing for people to involve themselves in.
Part of your vision for the Portland Project was that children would play in it, but I understand
Absolutely.
The city of Portland didn't want the children to play in it, and you had to take them to court?
No, that isn't true. That's
but there
one
was
of
some
myths.
Sort of is that a myth?
Yeah.
What happened in Portland?
They were surprised, but I didn't have to take anybody to court.
Uh-huh.
At the very beginning, I explained that what we were trying. You must bear in mind that the first fountains that I, in a sense, were ever designed for people and children, particularly, to be allowed to go into, happened in Portland. And in that sense, it was groundbreaking, or maybe we should say waterbreaking. And for them, it was a surprise that instead of having signs around saying, stay out of the water or stay off the grass, we encouraged people to come into it. At the very beginning, they were a little surprised that I was delighted and wanted people to come in. The first day that we turned on the first fountain there, the Lovejoy, thousands of people came and started playing around in the water, and they were startled about it. And it was simply a matter of my saying to them, this is exactly what we wanted and what we intended, and that was that. We didn't have to go to court at all.
Well, that seems quite the obverse of what happens to a lot of public spaces, where a city will decide to put in, we need some open space here, let's put in a giant plaza, and it becomes a windswept, barren desert rather than a place through which people want to move.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, things change, and one of the things that pleases me about Portland and some of the early work in Portland is that it has become almost accepted by now in cities that plazas have a life of their own, which are devoted to people's enjoyment and use, and that water and people's involvement in it is something that you ought to plan for. So I think that although what you said could perhaps have been the case 30 years ago, by now, almost every plaza that we're involved in, or many, many other people are too, the understanding that citizens have, and for that reason the Board of Supervisors or City Councils, is that a plaza ought to do for the city all the things that you spoke of, and that which I wish also, and that is they become a center for the city, a center of life and enjoyment, and a place which for the public becomes more than just one thing, but symbolic of the whole city.
My guest is Lawrence Halprin. He's a landscape architect. He's designed many large public spaces in the Bay Area of California, where he lives. He designed Ghirardelli Square, the Embarcadero, and Sea Ranch. Halprin's works can also be experienced, walked through in cities including Seattle, Minneapolis, Portland, Florence, and Jerusalem. Halprin's also written several books on his theories and projects. He's joining us from KQED Radio in San Francisco. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Lawrence Halprin, he's a landscape architect and urban planner. Who are all the different people that you need to incorporate in planning for a project? You've developed a technique called taking part, some RSVP workshops. What goes on in these? Who are the kinds of people that you invite to help you plan a public project?
It depends a great deal on what the project is, of course, but one of the major things that groups of people that we use are users, are the people who are going to either live there or use it or somehow be involved, not on a casual and external basis from somewhere else, not experts, but the actual people themselves who are going to be involved in its use, maintenance, and for whom the place is enhancing their lives. A recent workshop that we just did, for example, involved a group of people, 100 people or more, for the island of Alcatraz, which we had been commissioned by the Golden Gate National Parks Association to try to evolve not only a design for, but also to take and evolve a philosophical attitude about how should it be used, what should it be, what should it include, and how should it become something that all the people of the Bay Area and for all the country would be interested in. We involved many, many different people with different attitudes, biologists, anthropologists, scientists, individual people, users of different ages, so that we would get an overview idea of what all the people, as many as we could, would feel good about as we started our designs for Alcatraz. That's the point of view that we always take in these workshops, and that is as many people who are deeply and emotionally and functionally going to be involved in a place can participate with us in determining what's going to happen.
Pictures I've seen of these workshops have long lines of people on their hands and knees writing on long scrolls of paper. What is this part of the procedure?
Well, the reason for that is this. My point of view about the environment, as it is the fundament of life itself, is that many different senses and ways of communication are extremely important for people in their attitudes about and their contributions to designs of places. That talking about something is just one particular way of communication. In fact, there are many, many people who don't communicate very well on a verbal level, but can communicate either on a dance level, on a movement level, on a drawing level, on a sign language level, on all kinds of levels, in ways that draw from them what they're trying to communicate, which go way beyond the just talking. And so in all our workshops, we make it possible for people to communicate with us and with each other in ways which are nonverbal, which get at deeper levels of human endeavor or human communication. As you know, when young children are raised, some of the most important ways that parents and grandparents can communicate with them are not through words, but through their feelings, through their touching, through their attitudes. And that's what we're trying to achieve also in these workshops. And so what you see on these lines of people writing, what they're doing is either writing something about how they feel about it, or they're making drawings, or they're communicating in different ways, and then they put them up on the wall and use those as a way of telling other people in the workshop what they feel and what they'd like to have happen. And then also there are other ways too. Sometimes in Alcatraz and in other workshops, small theater groups have actually put on little plays that tell about what they want to have happen. These are all methods of giving people opportunities to communicate with each other in a deeply right brain way rather than always on a left brain way, that is, intuitively, emotionally, empathetically.
Do these people then create ideas that you're able to incorporate in their work, or is it just allowing them to feel a part of the planning process?
No. It does both, of course. When you have contributed, you do feel part of things, and that is a very important byproduct. But the real reason for these workshops is the contribution of ideas, and the ideas can go as deeply or as shallowly or as surfacely as people want. They can leave it just, we would like to have such and such a facility, which is fairly simple. Or they can go deeper and say, we would like it to look like this, or we would like it to feel like this, or when we're inside of it, we would like to be able to do this. So that the level of contribution is as deep as people can make it. And we try in our workshops to make that depth of communication as deep as possible. So yes, it's not only to get them to feel part of it and committed to it, but the actual ideas very often come from the workshops.
You're just now recovering from a hip replacement, and you have a limited walking range while you're recuperating. How does this affect your sense of mobility and moving within a space, how other people who might be also physically challenged will react? Is this changing your attitude as an urban planner?
I think what it's changed mostly is my understanding of dependency. It's something that I haven't quite coped with yet, because I'm not over it yet. I can't put on my own socks, for example, or my own underwear. I depend on my wife to do that, and she giggles all the time in the morning because she said, boy, you really don't like this, do you? The sense of dependency has not been something that I've, on somebody else, has not been something that I've understood. I've also had to have people drive me around. I have found it difficult, and it's made it more understandable to me how other people who are handicapped or disabled, as they prefer to be known as, how they must feel. And that in that sense, I'm glad for this experience. I haven't sorted out yet what this sense of dependency means for me, but I do know that I want to get over it as quickly as possible, and therefore my friends who have been permanently disabled, I understand how deeply and desperately they want the sense of independent ability to cope with their own life, even on a limited basis. In addition to that, of course, I did do a study and a movie about the relationship of disabled people to their environment, which is available for use. I had, through workshops with disabled people, had a sense of the, of understanding of this relationship. But now it's more as usual. When you experience something on your own and it's non-intellectual, you really learn more about it, and that's how I feel right now.
Do you go back to any of your sites and just sort of hang out, lean against the wall, and watch how people are using it? You converted the Ghirardelli Chocolate Factory on San Francisco Bay into the Ghirardelli Center, now filled with shops and restaurants, multi-layers, parking garage underneath, one of the great urban redevelopment projects of the early 60s. Do you go back and just hang out and watch how people use it?
Sure, I do that. I haven't done that with Ghirardelli for a while now, but I try as often as possible to go back and sit and look and enjoy.
What pleases you most when you...
it's very simple. What pleases me most, if I sit there and watch people enjoy themselves, and people of all ages, and if I can see people sitting in the sun and talking with each other, children playing in the water, if I can feel events happening, as at the Embarcadero, the great plaza there that we did, I enjoy enormously watching all the events that happen there, all the people who use it. At Levi Strauss, I enjoy people's sense of being in nature. In fact, one of the great things that people said to me a couple of months ago is what we enjoy so much is that you've brought the dragonflies back into the city and the birds. Sure, I enjoy very much watching that happen. I think it's also true, however, that inevitably I'm forward-oriented rather than backward-oriented, and what I enjoy most is the drawings and models and other things that I'm making for some of the newer projects.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking with us on Fresh Air today.
Right. I've enjoyed it.
Lawrence Halprin's public spaces can be seen in San Francisco, Portland, Oregon, Minneapolis, Florence, and Jerusalem. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with one of Canada's preeminent novelists, Robertson Davies. Davies' books include The Deptford Trilogy and What's Bred in the Bone. His new novel is titled The Lyre of Orpheus. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. I'm here from California for Terry Gross on Holiday Elsewhere. Bruce Chatwin regularly traveled to lands most of us have barely heard of, and he brought back from those journeys some of the finest travel writing of this generation. Coming up on Fresh Air, we remember Bruce Chatwin, who died earlier this week. Also, we'll speak with writer Don Carpenter. Carpenter's latest novel follows a family coming apart in affluent Marin County, California, a scene at odds with the stereotypical East Coast image of Northern California. Coming up, Don Carpenter talks about his home in fact and fiction. And critic at large Laurie Stone shares her views on the work of performance artist John O'Keefe. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Nora Rahm in Washington. It was breezy and mild in Washington today when George Bush became the 41st president of the United States. Details from NPR's Linda Wertheimer.
A minute or two after 12 o'clock this afternoon, the leadership of the Western world passed from one man to another by the simple act of repeating a 35-word oath of office administered by the Chief Justice of the United States, the Honorable William Rehnquist.
I, George Herbert Walker Bush, do solemnly swear.
I, George Herbert Walker Bush, do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
And will to the best of my ability.
And will to the best of my ability.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
The ruffles and flourishes and hail to the chief for President George Bush, the 41st president, taking his oath on the Bible used 200 years before by George Washington. I'm Linda Wertheimer in Washington.
In his inaugural address to an estimated 200,000 people at the west front of the Capitol, Bush repeatedly used the phrase "new breeze" as an apparent signal of the changes he plans to bring to the White House. Saying that material possessions should not be taken as the sum of our lives, Bush stressed the importance of engaging the country in high moral principle. The president acknowledged the long list of problems he inherits, including increasing crime, drug abuse, and the budget deficit. It was goodbye for former President Reagan today. He and wife Nancy walked hand in hand through the White House for the last time, bidding farewell to staff and reporters. After the inauguration, the Ronald Reagans boarded a plane to Los Angeles and retirement from office. President Bush will cap today's inaugural events with appearances at 8 formal parties in the nation's capital. In one of his last acts as Energy Secretary, John Harrington yesterday endorsed construction of a weapons-grade plutonium refinery in Boise, Idaho. As Jill Hoyt of member station KBSU reports, the decision is getting mixed reviews.
The Special Isotope Separator, or SIS, would refine plutonium for use in nuclear weapons. Plutonium is the most dangerous substance known, and many Idahoans are worried that the refinery could pollute their water. The majority of people who testified at the public hearings last year were opposed to the project, but those who live and work at the Idaho National Engineering Laboratory, where the SIS would be built, are happy about the jobs a plutonium plant could bring. One environmental group says it will file a lawsuit charging that the SIS isn't needed. The real test, though, will come in Congress, where funding for the billion-dollar project has already met with opposition. For National Public Radio, I'm Jill Hoyt in Boise.
A full-scale space shuttle booster was test-fired near Brigham City, Utah today. The booster had been chilled to 40 degrees for the firing, since the test was designed to prove that new O-ring joints will stand up to winter launches. The joints had been redesigned after the explosion of the Space Shuttle Challenger. Faulty joints have been blamed for that disaster. A federal prosecutor said today that secret national security documents were found on the desk of a Korean-American businessman charged with trying to export deadly nerve gas. Assistant U.S. Attorney Ann Singer said the papers, marked classified and confidential, were found in the Summit, New Jersey office of Yuhan Yun. She said that Yun could be charged with unauthorized possession of secret documents. Stock prices were lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 3 points to close at 2235.36. Declines led advances 7-5 on volume of 166 million shares. The average price of a share lost 2 cents. This is National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. British novelist and travel writer Bruce Chatwin died last Tuesday at the age of 48. Chatwin began his writing career by deciding to quit his job. He pulled up stakes to travel, to write the stories he found and those that found him. Chatwin's 1977 book, In Patagonia, chronicled his solitary journey through South America. The book brought him instant recognition, but he kept traveling. Ironically, his passion for exploration also led to his death. Chatwin died from a rare bone disease he caught while traveling in western China, which progressively disabled him. He just completed a set of essays called What Am I Doing Here? His most recent book, Utz, is a novel published just last week. English writer Andrew Harvey once wrote in the New York Times, "Nearly every writer of my generation in England wanted at some point to be Bruce Chatwin. From Mr. Chatwin, we learned to dare to be obsessive, irregular, learned, exotic." Chatwin spoke with Terry Gross in 1987, following the publication of Songlines about Australian Aborigines. He told Terry that his restlessness, his urge to travel, originated in childhood.
I was brought up wandering around wartime England in that very, very highly charged atmosphere. I was born in 1940. My first recollections are of the Battle of Alamein, of hearing Winston Churchill coming through one of those brown plastic radios and then dancing around with my mother. I was hanging onto my grandmother's legs and her stockings fell down. I deeply remember. That's one of my first recollections. But we lived out of a suitcase. All my early recollections are of, kit bags coming through windows, blackouts, and all those kind of exciting things. And we, from one set of rented rooms to another, all through wartime England. And when we then settled down after the war in those rather grim post-war years in a house for the first time, it wasn't much of a house because we had no money, I associated settlement with some kind of terrible depression. And I think whenever I've got holed up, as it were, then my way of solving my particular crises is to move.
Well, you spent part of your early adulthood working at Sotheby's, the famous art auction house.
Yeah.
And I think you directed the Impressionism department for a while.
Roughly, yes.
But
there were others.
You gave up that life. You had a very good position.
Oh, yes.
What was there a turning point for you where you decided to give up a regular working job and to ditch it all so you could go travel?
Well, put it this way. My mother, when I left school, I wanted to travel in Africa. My mother didn't actually like the idea. My parents didn't quite like the idea of their 18-year-old son sort of dashing around Africa, but they sort of said, well, okay, fine. You can go and work in Sotheby's as a porter for a little while, and then if you don't like it, then you can go. But just sort of give it a try. So I went and I worked as a porter, and then I became a kind of instant expert. Those were the days in the art business when nobody seemed to know very much. Within a matter of no time, I was pronouncing with sort of insufferable arrogance on the authenticity of paintings, whether they were genuine or not, I don't know. But nevertheless, I had this career in the art business. But then I got a kind of psychosomatic eye complaint. My right eye went rather funny. And the eye surgeon to whom I went in London said, Bruce, I think you've been looking too closely at pictures. There's nothing wrong with you organically. Why don't you swap them for some long horizons? Where would you like to go? So I said Africa, which was the place which I'd somehow been prevented from going to before. So I went to Africa, and then I saw nomad peoples for the first time, and I felt it was quite wonderful the way in which my travelling companions had this immense pride in having nothing, whereas all our pride, or my particular pride up till then, had been towards accumulation of things and everything else.
Had you been collecting a lot of art?
Oh, yes. I had a wonderful group of things, even bought on a shoestring, but I had things which would today be worth I don't know what.
Most of us, when we travel, take suitcases of clothes and books, and I know some people who even take television sets and video cassette recorders so they can catch up on movies when they're traveling.
God help them, yes. God help them.
Do you travel light?
Oh, absolutely. I have a little sort of rucksack. This is, I suppose, a bit of a show-off remark, but the great and wonderful French actor Jean-Louis Barrault. Was somebody I met. I met him on a plane, and he had at his feet the most beautiful leather rucksack, very, very small. I mean, tiny, really tiny. And I asked him about it, and he said, I've got an apartment in Paris. I live there with my wife and everything else. But actually, this object, which I bought to go on a walking tour when I was 16 in the Tyrol in the 30s is my home. And I have to say that I copied that, and I had one made, and it's a kind of pillow, comforter. There's a slot in the side for a bottle. When I went to Patagonia, I put a half bottle of rather good champagne in the pocket for the worst possible moment, and otherwise I really take nothing, hardly anything in it, just a change of warm clothes, and I'm off. And one watches, if you go into those wild places, you watch. Very often you find expeditions of university expedition to this and that, with a lot of very bad-tempered people all looking around a Land Rover which has got stuck in the dust or the mud, and I must say I'm thankful for my little rucksack that enables me to go on to the next thing.
I love this idea of having a little bottle of champagne for the worst possible moment. what was the occasion for actually drinking it?
In Tierra del Fuego, which is one of the most sort of grisly... But it isn't so cold, but it's pretty wet. There's a constant storm going, a constant rainstorm. And I did... I was crossing one of those kind of corrugated paths of logs across a swamp, and one of the logs got dislodged, and I went in. I never thought that I'd actually come out again, this glutinous black mud, and covered to foot, from head to foot, quite cold, in the middle of absolutely nowhere. That is the moment when I sat down and drank my half bottle.
Did it taste good?
Delicious. Krug is an excellent mark.
Writer Bruce Chatwin spoke with Terry Gross in 1987. Chatwin died last Tuesday at the age of 48 of a rare disease he caught while traveling in western China. This is Fresh Air. Beneath the layers of wealth in San Francisco's affluent suburb of Marin County, novelist Don Carpenter sees impoverished, desperate souls. From a distant place, Carpenter's ninth novel chronicles the sad lives of people who appear to have it all. He's also written for television and the movies. He wrote the screenplay for the 1973 film Payday that starred Rip Torn as a hard-luck country singer on his last binge. Carpenter grew up in Berkeley and has spent his adulthood chronicling life along the West Coast. But as a young writer, staying in the West wasn't the obvious choice.
When I was a kid, of course, like every other writer in America, I looked to New York. I thought that was the capital of things, and of course it was. And there's a choice for a young writer. You can either go to the capital, you know, put your belongings in your handkerchief and head down the road, and go to the capital and try to make it in the world of literature, or you can stay home, wherever you are, like Faulkner did, and a lot of others, and try to work it out from there, and try to write about what you see around you, and paint, you know, and not listen to the siren song from the east. And that's what I ended up doing, although I never really made a clear decision to do that.
Mm-hmm. From a Distant Place is set in Mill Valley, which is a bucolic town in what is probably one of the most affluent counties of the country. Yet it's a story of disintegration within a family that, for all intents and purposes, seems to have everything else that the rest of mainstream America is striving for. I'd like for you to read a bit from A Distant Place, your new novel.
Sure.
And if you could set up a bit about the character of Jackie Jeminovsky and the scene we're about to hear from the beginning of the book.
Well, Jackie is a woman who everyone thinks has it made because she drives a Jag and she lives in a four-bedroom suburban house, and she's, even though she's middle-aged, she's 45, she has kept a quite marvelous appearance. And so from the outside, just like Marin County and just like California, she looks great. Has it made? In fact, people are even envious of her, but the truth is somewhat different.
Hmm.
And that's what I write about all the time. So I'll just read this little
segment. Jackie was crazy to go on living in that big house. 4 bedrooms and nobody came home anymore. She'd thought about renting out a couple of rooms, but her pride got in the way. I am just too screwed up for roommates, she thought. But the fact was that she liked to start out her day with a bottle of Green Death, Rainier Ale, which was practically harmless. But she knew it gave her bad breath and people thought less of you. When men stayed over, she either skipped her ale or for some reason they would both have something to drink. Men like to take women, especially good-looking women, out to breakfast after a night together. Show them off to the boys lined up at the bar nursing their hangovers. She liked to go to Perry's down in Mill Valley and start the day off right with Eggs Benedict and a Ramos Fizz. But that was only on weekends, and it had been a while since anybody had stayed over anyhow.
Alcohol plays a role as a character in this book. Jackie progressively...
Well, alcoholism sort of serves as an objective correlative for dysfunction.
Uh-huh.
And the reason I used it that way, I don't want to get technical, but the reason I used it was because I'm an alcoholic myself. And in the course of this book, although the main character is a woman, the alcoholic in the story is a woman, her trip through alcoholism is actually pretty much the same trip that I took in my own downhill slide several years ago. And I wanted to get that on paper, but I didn't want to write about a writer who is a drunk. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What led you to drink, to become an alcoholic?
Well, I started drinking when I was 13. And looking back on it, a million years later, I realized that I drank to cover myself. I didn't get along easily with the other kids. I had a lot of ambition, and I wanted to be in the heart of things. But it wasn't working for me. But if I was drinking, if I was drunk, it didn't matter what I did. The alcohol would be blamed for it. And then, it becomes a habit. It becomes a situation where you never go to a party without getting drunk.
And, of course, one of the great myths is that you can write when you're drunk.
I've never tried that. I've written a lot with hangovers. But writing when you're drunk is a lot like writing when you've been smoking marijuana or snorting cocaine. It seems great at the time, but you look at it sober the next day and it's garbage.
You spend part of your day going down to the bookstore and coffee shop that's in the center of Mill Valley, and I've heard this described as your office.
Actually, it's my living room.
Oh.
I make a point of, after I finish writing in the morning, I will walk down the hill to the depot, which is the coffee shop and bookstore, and talk to people. Or if there's no one there that I know, I just sort of sit among the voices. You can't isolate yourself too much. And if I stayed home 24 hours a day, which I did for several years, you really get strange.
Do you find yourself inspired or overwhelmed or intimidated or protected by the fact there are shelves and shelves of books all around you?
Yes, very much so.
All
it's
of them?
It's not just that there are shelves and shelves of books all around you. It's that there are shelves and shelves of great books. It's sort of like being a teacher of literature and trying to write yourself. A teacher of literature is faced every day with the greatest writers in the world. And then he goes home and he tries to write his own stuff. And it's a terrible, terrible comparison, and it's very much overwhelming. Like, never read James Joyce the night before you write. It's going to kill you. Same with Hemingway. You end up writing like these guys, and then, of course, you have to throw it away.
You lived in San Francisco during the Beat era, the era of black turtleneck shirts and black jeans and jazz in the clubs and espresso.
Oh, yes.
How have you seen the writing environment of the Bay Area change? Do you meet more people in the Bay Area who are full writers than in the 50s, or is the proportion about the same?
Well, there are many, many more writers now. But during the part of the Beat period that I was involved in, the early and middle 50s, North Beach was a paradise for young writers because nowhere else was. If you were a young poet living in Wichita, Kansas, You were accused of being a homosexual and a communist and whatever pejoratives I can think of. But when you came to San Francisco, you were greeted by other poets. And it was really exciting to go into the City Lights bookstore in 1952 or 1953. But this drew a lot of writers to the Bay Area, and yet still to this day, there is no literary community in San Francisco. Many of the writers know each other, but they don't hang out together. There's no place for them to go, and we like this, because the opposite is New York, where the literary world is concentrated. And in New York, everything is ranked. You are judged quite coldly in terms of whether you're critically acceptable or financially acceptable.
Do you feel any need to get out of town from now to again, sort of refresh your eyes, or are you...
This trip from Mill Valley to San Francisco was quite wonderful. This morning, a 20-minute ride across the Golden Gate Bridge is magnificent. But if you mean the way a student would get out and see the world in order to write about it, I've already done that. And I don't think you can go out deliberately, you know, and take notes on life. Years ago, Norman Mailer was in danger of going to prison for an incident with his wife. And I wrote to him and I said, well, at least if you go to prison, you'll know that you're going to write the greatest prison novel of all time. And he wrote back and said, if I did that, I'd be going tourist and it wouldn't be a good book at all. And that makes a great deal of sense. You can't be a tourist in life and still write about it. You've got to actually be there.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in, crossing the Golden Gate Bridge, and thanks very much, Don Carpenter.
Thank you.
Don Carpenter's new novel, From a Distant Place, is published by North Point Press. He spoke to us via satellite from KQED-FM in San Francisco. This is Fresh Air. Coming up in a while, it'll be All Things Considered from National Public Radio. We'll go down to Washington, where, of course, there have been big events, festivities, inauguration today. Robert Siegel, host of All Things Considered, were you there?
Well, I was in Washington, D.C., but I dare say that the closest I came to it was on the commute in from Virginia this morning. I've been indoors ever since. We will have, however, reports from our Washington Bureau, people who were there. We'll be hearing about what the president said and did. We also have a Jim Angle report about George Bush and the political ideas, values, and the personality he brings to office. We also run the inaugural address past a writer, Harold Brodkey, the novelist and short story writer. See what he made of it.
Encyclopedic as usual. Thank you, Robert Siegel. All Things Considered, coming up later here on National Public Radio. More often than not, performance art is a multimedia show that overwhelms the usual constraints of the stage, but critic at large Laurie Stone says performance artist John O'Keefe has simplified the form to tell the story of his rough childhood in an orphanage.
Performance art tends to be fragmented, sententious, and tricked up with slides and sound effects. Shimmer, John O'Keefe's unified, stirring solo piece, graces the genre. It uncovers the richness of autobiographical monologue when grounded in tense writing and limber acting. O'Keefe is a compact man in his mid-40s. His eyes have known loss, and his street fighter arms have fended off aggression. Violence crackles on his skin, nodding to beatings he suffered and served up, evoking the eroticized familiarity of pain. But the performer moves with the energy of a kid, and his voice, which can slide into a resonant baritone, is free of cynicism, sarcasm. Shimmer tells the story of his early life. O'Keefe grew up in Iowa in a series of Catholic orphanages and state juvenile homes that were run like prisons. His father was a mean alcoholic, his mother an abused, scattered woman who was deemed unfit to raise him. O'Keefe meets Gary, who arrives at the juvenile home when O'Keefe is nearly 16. O'Keefe is known as Spacey because he wants to be an astronaut. But until he meets Gary, he has no ally in imaginative flight. The other kids think Gary is weird, and he is. He believes penguins and seals dive to a blue ice world and discover what human beings have yet to learn. He thinks radio static is really a secret language. He calls it shimmer. The performance, which lasts 75 minutes, is a lyric evocation of caged adolescence, with echoes of Oliver Twist in The 400 Blows. O'Keefe etches the horrors of the juvenile home with a remarkable absence of grievance. It's the intimate's matter-of-factness. His world is one of ham-fisted guards and brutal matrons. Lights must be turned off at 8:30 p.m. 5 razor straps hang menacingly in the hall leading to the showers, and in the cafeteria, where no one is permitted to speak, if boys and girls so much as make eye contact, the penalty is a whack that makes mouths bleed and ears ring for a day. Eventually, Spacey and Gary hatch an escape, and it is thrillingly suspenseful, adrenalized dada, with terror time drawn out like liquid and barbed wire boundaries heedlessly risked. As the boys taste freedom, O'Keefe becomes drunkenly gleeful. A man who gives them a ride in a Bel Air convertible and plays Buddy Holly on his radio brings them, as O'Keefe says, out of captivity like a rock and roll Moses. On the page, shimmer would have poignancy and power, but the conviction and concentration in O'Keefe's performance give it immediacy, wholeness. He works on a bare stage, save for a music stand with notes. He moves with authority and a sensualist's awareness of gesture. Through shifts in his voice and posture, he becomes other characters, but the story is always channeled through Spacey or through O'Keefe the man. In the figure on stage, we see the person made by these events. His sculpted haircut bespeaks a pride skirting vanity. His white T-shirt and jeans are both a stay-at-home uniform and garb showing that Spacey grew into an actor, not a suit and a tie. He grew as well into a deft shaper of his own experience. Most performance artists put their entrails on stage, then foolishly fancy that because they do so with the solemnity of soothsayers, there must be prophecy and magic in them. O'Keefe uses autobiography to reveal a world.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. On our next show, I speak with anthropologist Peter Nabokov. He says that when he was a boy, his grandfather put an arrowhead in his hand, and the barb stuck. Since then, he's spent his life studying the culture of Native Americans. In his new book, he surveys their architecture, which he thinks of as a window to their way of life. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews 2 recent albums by composer and arranger Carla Bley. Television critic David Bianculli previews a new PBS children's show called Shining Time Station. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Tim Jacoby. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Sedge Thompson. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.